Welcome to All the Ways I've Failed. This podcast is recorded on the unceded lands of the Yugambeh people. We pay our respects to the traditional custodians and their continued connection to the land and sea on which we live, work and create. Hello there, my name is Beck Marshall-Say. I am a writer, an academic and the author of children's picture book Facing the Wave. All the Ways I've Failed is not only for writers but for anyone who creates, strives and fails along the way. Today I'm talking with Poppy G. Poppy teaches journalism and creative writing and is the author of Bay of Fires and Vanishing Falls. Poppy, welcome to All the Ways I've Failed.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to be talking to you.
So before we get started and dig into your thoughts on failure, as someone who teaches creative writing and someone who is a creative writer themselves, what's one thing that your friends or family would say that you are categorically no good at, that you're destined to fail at?
I actually ran out and asked my 8-year-old boy that question quickly before we started, and he said straight away, singing. Which
brutal
is true, but sad because I do like to sing. And he also said motorbike riding, which I'm happy. I own that. I can't ride a motorbike. That's fine.
Probably something you can cope with not being great at. Can you tell me who would enjoy reading The Bay of Fires and Vanishing Falls?
I think my perfect reader is, like, I write crime and I brand myself as a crime author. But I do, when I'm telling people about my book, I do say it's a literary crime novel or it's a literary mystery, because I think people that enjoy my books are people who read widely across all genres, as opposed to there are certain people that just love crime novels. They like a police detective type novel or a really tightly plotted thriller. And my books are neither of those. My books are a little bit more about character and place and culture and society on the scaffold of a crime novel. So I guess as a reader, I want people to find a book that they will love as much as I love finding a book that I will love. So I don't want to trick someone into reading my book if they think it's a straightforward crime novel, because it might not be perfect for them. So I do often sort of give a little bit of a warning to people that it's a bit more literary, I guess, explains it more than it's, a strict police procedural or something.
And Tasmania plays a huge role in the setting and the ambiance of your books. Before you started writing these, did you know that that was your style of writing, or is that something that you discovered as you wrote your books, that it wasn't just a straight crime novel?
Yeah, it's so funny that it's such an interesting question, because I think I've always loved horror movies. I've loved psychological thrillers, and I really like dark fiction. Anything that's quite dark and twisted, I'm drawn to. I was trying with my first novel, like I'd written 5 manuscripts before Bay of Fires, before I wrote Bay of Fires, and they were all probably trying to be a book that would win the Miles Franklin. That was sort of my understanding of what books were. You wrote something that won the Miles Franklin or the Vogel Australian Award for unpublished manuscript. But when I wrote The Bay of Fires, there was a missing person, a murdered person, and so that I wrote it through the UQ Creative Writing Masters program, and my supervisor, Venera Amano, who's a wonderful Brisbane author and he heads up the creative writing department at UQ, he said, he sort of knew I was sort of fumbling my way into whatever I was trying to write, and he said, it's a crime novel because you've got a crime, and he said the interesting bits in your novel are the bits that are about the crime, so try to do more of those. And he pointed me towards Gary Disher and said, you know, read his novels are so beautifully written and very well plotted. And so I guess that I sort of headed that way because of that. I didn't set out to write a crime novel, but I'm not surprised that I have. And now I could choose tomorrow to sit down and write anything, but I do like something that has a crime, because I think it's a good way of digging in and looking at who we are as a society, and, you know, getting below the surface and seeing the underbelly of the society that we live in. And I don't know that we make a comment as a writer, but asking questions about that is where my interest is drawn to.
I love that. I did in my undergrad, I discovered the politics of film as a subject, which was analysing films and sort of straightforward tropes, you know, the disaster film or the, you know, alien invaders film. And then unpacking what it said about us as a society, what sort of anxieties we held or what we valued or who we valued. And it blew my mind. And it's something that I, you know, went on to use through my master's and even with my law degree, that unpacking the type of stories we tell. And again, what they say about us, what sort of cultural, political, social norms are at play at the time. I just think it's really interesting that those things all sit there, whether you are trying to write a Miles Franklin or whether you're trying to write, you know, a hard-boiled thriller, those things still present themselves as part of that sort of storytelling dynamic.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think when you take, you know, a crime in a small community, which is what I do, it really shines a light on everyone. You know, we often say when we have a disaster, it brings out the best in people, but of course it brings out the worst as well. So I sort of like looking at that dynamic. Because I grew up in Launceston in Tasmania, which is a fairly small town, and I find that sort of small town environment make a very powerful, it's a microcosm of a larger society, but it's a powerful way to nut out different issues and themes, but within sort of a small confined space.
You said that you did the Bay of Fires through a Masters of Creative Writing. Can you tell me a little bit about that process? Because that's something that some novelists do through a Masters or PhD, and it's a bit of a different process because you have someone's eyes on it quite early in the piece, guiding you and giving you feedback.
Yeah, it's one way to do it. I wouldn't necessarily recommend it to everyone. So I had written 5 full-length manuscripts when I began that course, and when I'm on the first day of starting that master's program, I already had a draft of Bay of Fires, and I felt like I'd written these 5 unpublished manuscripts, and each year I'd entered them in the Vogel Award for Unpublished Manuscript. Probably I'd entered 4 by that point when I started the course. It was almost every second year I was entering a novel in the Vogel, and I looked at what authors I admired, like say someone like Kate Grenville, and what was their path to publication. And I noticed that a few of them had done the Creative Writing Masters in some form. So that's what drew me to it. And I think it was good because obviously it gave me access to Venny, who is amazing, and Hilary Emmett, who supervised the theoretical part of my work, which was the exegesis, like a long essay. And I think that was very helpful, but it certainly is a step, like it's a stepping stone. There were only four students in my cohort, and we met every month and workshopped each other's work. So I will always owe a debt to them because I think their feedback and constructive criticism helped me shape my novel. And certainly for me, that was really, really valuable. So all the 4 students in my cohort have been published. One young adult writer, one's literary fiction, and one is sort of literary travel essays. So we're all quite different, but I think we were fortunate that year. And then at the end of that program, I sort of as a joke, I was a Friday night and I was having a glass of wine with my husband, and I typed literary agent New York into Google, and I looked through all the pages of all the different literary agents and found one that looked quite pretty. And then I read through their bios and isolated one agent that I thought she represented some books that I hadn't read, but they sounded a little bit like mine, sort of dark literary crime novels. And she said on her bio that she likes books that linger with her long after she's finished reading, which is me. That's what I like. I love books that you think about for ages. And so I emailed her. She read the first 3 chapters. So this was in December. By the end of January, she'd offered to represent me. And by the end of April, she'd sold the manuscript. And so this all happened really quickly. And knowing now what I didn't know then, I realized what a miracle it was and how lucky it was. But I just was quite naive, and I was pleased. I was excited, but I just sort of thought this is what happens. And it's quite straightforward. And, you know, she sold the novel within a week at what's called a preempt for 6 figures. Like I went and wrote an article for an Australian news website that said how I sold my novel in a week or something. But it's funny that I sort of feel like when you hear of people's writing journeys, it's like adversity, 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 and then this triumph. Whereas I feel like mine was kind of triumph, and then the adversity came after. So that, you know, I have had to swallow some bitter pills since then. But I embraced being a published novelist with absolute naivety and blissful ignorance. I just thought it was wonderful. I went out and bought this bright pink coat from David Jones because I thought I'll need that for my North American book tour. My mother's group all chipped in and bought me this nice pink like passport wallet for traveling, because I just thought I would, you know, I'm a published author. My book was being published in 2013, January. So I thought winter in New York. My dad even said to me, he said, have you got the date for the New York book launch? I'm like, no. And then I had to get back to him and go, I don't think it's going to happen, Dad. And we were like, oh, okay. I just had no idea. And I think I thought the people that I knew were published were people like John Grisham, you know, Jackie Collins. And I just thought, this is what happens. And it wasn't, like, that was fine. I wrote my next novel, you know, during that time of being acquired and during the time that that novel was published. And it was another crime novel, and it was about 200,000 words long. So in all this blissful euphoria of being a published novelist, I didn't even take the time to Google, how do you write a crime novel? How long should it be? So my agent, my poor agent, I've still got the same agent today. She's like, you've written 200,000 words. You need to cut it. It should be like 80,000 words roughly. And so that like took another year. And then the publisher in New York turned it down. And so that for me, like, this podcast is about failure. That was absolutely devastating, because I just sort of, I don't want to sound egotistical, but I just assumed I was on this amazing journey for the rest of my life. I didn't realize that they would knock it back. And they said no, very nicely. And I was so embarrassed and ashamed. I didn't even tell anyone for 6 months, not even my husband, because everyone had been so excited for me and everybody kept saying, when's your next novel coming out? And I just kept saying, oh, I'm working away, when really I didn't know when my next novel would come out. And all I knew was that the current publisher had turned it down. It's just weird, because if you don't, like, your relationship with your agent is very professional. Your relationship with your publisher is very professional too. And so there's, if you don't have a mentor, which I didn't, there was no one I could really discuss this with who knew. My other friends who were writers were at similar or even earlier stages than me. So we could speculate about what it meant. But yeah, it was very disappointing, because I was thinking about this podcast and I was thinking about what constitutes failure. And I thought, well, when are the times I've actually cried about writing? And that was obviously one. Yeah.
That pressure to do again, I think, is very hard. I find that even writing picture books, which I currently do, that people say, oh, when's the next book coming? And it makes you feel like you're an imposter, or that you've just flicked it.
Yeah.
Because I find myself having to say, oh, well, it's a really slow going, you know, it's a really slow going industry, because I'm not represented as well. So getting in front of big publishers means maybe there's one opportunity a year if you can get into a speed dating thing and if you can pitch. So even if you can get in front of publishers, it's hard and few and far between. And I guess for me as well, I've always felt, you know, confident that I'd be published again, but it takes a lot longer than you think, and it's still a hard process. Don't get me wrong, I think getting published is an amazing foot in the door. It opens up access to all sorts of things that come with the credibility of that, and teaching and, you know, doing school talks and all those things, but it's still slow. And I had a very similar experience in terms of my picture book, Facing the Wave. It was my first submission and it got picked up straight away.
Oh,
and
wow.
I felt really confident about it. But then again, I've had, you know, plenty of rejections. I've got plenty of manuscripts that are sitting out in someone's slush pile somewhere, and you're just hoping it will get picked up.
Yeah.
And then it's hard, I think, especially like you said, when other people are excited and engaged for you and say, oh, how's it going? Not to go, oh yeah, I'm sorry. I'm a failure. I'm sorry. It hasn't happened yet. I'm, you know.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, we should be proud of our achievement. And that's what I say. I'm really proud of achieving what I've achieved, but I also don't take for granted that I will get another book published. Because I think part of the trouble is, probably like any industry, you only see the success stories. So, you know, I see people like the most beautiful person, Danuka McKenzie, and you look at her and she's published 3 books almost within 3 years, and you think that's normal. That's what should happen. But it's actually, she's lucky and she's amazing and she deserves it. But it's also not the most common scenario. I feel like my situation, your situation, is probably what most of us experience, that just because you get that first foot in the door and something published, it doesn't mean it's all easy from that point on. But I think there's something positive to be obtained out of this situation that we're in. I'd written 5 manuscripts that didn't get over the line. Well, number 5 did, That was Bay of Fires. And then I wrote three more. The third one became Vanishing Falls. So that's eight novels, but only two published. I've now got two more manuscripts sitting with my agent and a third one that we've been working on for over 10 years, which was that initial 200,000 word thing. So it's just such a long journey. But I certainly, if I went back and said, did I want that 200,000 word novel to be my second novel? I'm so glad it wasn't published. Like, it was horrendous, embarrassing. And I'm reworking it now and I've improved as a writer. So if it does get published, and I'm tentatively optimistic that it might, but it will be so much better and I'll be proud of it. Whereas, like, imagine, I don't know, like if that Bay of Fires had been like a New York Times bestselling novel and then they quickly pumped out my 200,000 word piece of trash, how embarrassing. You know, I feel like there's a blessing in a way of having the time to create and be thoughtful about what you're creating and to sort of insulate yourself from all that noise of the publishing industry, which we imagine, like, they're not putting the noise on us, but we're sort of trying to listen to it and tap into it. But if you can sort of close yourself off a bit from that and just write, I always believe, write like no one's going to read it. And then write from the heart, write as authentically as you can and write for the love of it. That's the point of writing, as opposed to writing for an audience. That's where I get the joy of it. And I certainly have heard many, you know, New York Times bestselling authors saying that their key advice is to people is to write from the heart, write for the love of it. Don't write for the market, because I think that's just a fast track for disappointment in a way and dissatisfaction.
I was speaking to a friend the other day who's not a writer, and we were discussing a couple of books that have come out in quite quick succession based on some TikTok popularity. And she said, the second one is terrible. She said it was, and she's outside of the sort of writing community, and she was spot on. She said, it just feels poorly edited. She said, it feels rushed. It just feels, you know, there's like all these errors in it. And she said, I feel like you can really tell it was written in 6 months. And
yeah,
so that outside pressure, and I think probably magnified now even more than 10 years ago with social media and,
yes,
you know, that quick turnaround and that desire for sort of instant gratification when you find something you love is probably even more so for authors these days.
I think so. I think we're so grateful for the publishing opportunity that we don't want it to slip through our fingers. And so therefore we will do anything we can to sort of, you know, hold it. And that, you know, maybe that's not the best thing for creating, you know, the better piece of work. Because my agent always says to me, take your time, take your time. And I think, I don't want to take my time. I want to pump out a book a year. But I think she's right. And I've seen it with other friends who are agented, getting back feedback from the agent that's really dense feedback that's going to take, you know, 6 months to rewrite, and it's disappointing. But then that's actually, they're doing you a favor in the end, because you're going to turn out something that's going to sit on the shelf forever that you can be really proud of.
And what about, you mentioned your initially five manuscripts and then the since your unpublished manuscripts, do you view them as, you know, a necessary cost in terms of word count and practice for getting a publication? You know, if someone said to you, you're going to write four books and then I guarantee the fifth one will be published, and you go, okay, no problem. Or are they all things that you still think you have a home that maybe will be repurposed, that, you know, will find their way into, you know, hopefully into publication in a different form down the track?
That's a good question. So no, I always think, when I sit down to write, if someone told me how long I would have to work on this novel to get it published, I probably wouldn't bother. It's just so much work. And I like writing the first draft, and I like editing, but there's a lot of boring stuff in, you know, there's a lot of like housekeeping stuff, just trying to, you know, it's a crime novel, so you've got to make sure the clues line up, and just going through it a million times. It's, yeah, like, I don't know, but I feel like it's not, the decision to write is not a logical, sensible decision. We do it because we enjoy it. We just like sitting down and fiddling with the words. And I think all of us would do it. Even if someone said, you're never going to be published, I would still be writing these novels. I like the challenge of that, you know, that structure of trying to, it's such a challenge to create a novel over 80,000 words or 90,000 words. And I love it. It's very satisfying when you sort of get to the end and you can see how everything's hanging together. But I think those early novels, yeah, it's like an apprenticeship in a way. You had to write them. I think I was entering them into Vogel, and that was probably one of the first times I've cried as a writer, when I was 34 and I entered my novel. And so the Vogel was for people aged under 35. That was my last chance. And I'd heard the Vogel judges saying that they look for something that's like really beautiful and polished and perfect, or a diamond in the rough. And so I had my fingers crossed that I was the diamond in the rough. And my friend, Eleanor Limprecht, she had entered perhaps the year before, and she hadn't been shortlisted, but she got written feedback from a judge, and we were really excited. It was just a paragraph, but it was really encouraging, telling Eleanor what a wonderful writer she was. So I was, if I couldn't be shortlisted, I was at least hoping for some written feedback. And when I just got the rejection that said, you know, like the template rejection, that said, thank you for entering, you haven't been successful, free to enter it wherever you like, that I did cry. I felt so disappointed, because I thought, well, that's it for me. I'm old, I'm 34, it's over.
Isn't that funny that you can pin it? It's a competition, and it's got so many, you know, so many fantastic entrants. I did something similar. I didn't cry, but with the Griffith Emerging Voices, they have a, you know, it's an essay for their journal, and entered and did not win out of 300 odd, 5 out of 300 odd entries got selected. But it still cut me as though, well, this piece is no good. See, this is terrible. You're a terrible writer. And it was a piece I felt really passionate about, and I reworked it from a university assignment. It's about this theory of, you know, the law and this philosophy about the homo sacer and who's excluded from the law, and women and LGBTIQ people, and just really passionate about it. And there's still that sense of, well, that's no good. It didn't come first out of 320 entries, so I'm terrible.
So hard on ourselves, because anyone else, it's funny, you know, logically you shouldn't be hard on yourself. And if a friend told you that story, you'd explain to them why they should be more forgiving. But when it's you, you don't. You tell yourself, you know, you've squandered your opportunity, or
and you take it from that the sense of, when it's yourself, it's not just that you've experienced failure. You turn it into that you are a failure.
Yeah.
It's the very important and unhealthy, I think, distinction.
It's interesting, because, you know, you hear there's a lot of podcasts about rejection. I've never labeled my experience as rejection. I see it as failure. I don't, like, rejection's rejection. But I think I don't, when I think of things that have happened to me, you know, like that publisher not wanting to publish my second novel, I didn't see it as a rejection. I just went, I have failed, which is so final.
It is, and so incredibly harsh, as you said. You wouldn't, if your friend said that, you'd say, but it's one publisher and they liked what you did elsewhere and they might like something again. And there's, you know, so many people are not going to like your work, but so many people will, and you can't apply that own perspective to your own experiences.
That's so true. Absolutely.
So we met as part of a writing community. So I was doing a reading with some picture book authors, and then I'd seen you at a couple of author book launches. And then I think we actually got to have a decent chat at the Brisbane Writing Crew catch up. What do you think the importance is of that sense of community and having other readers, other writers around who can keep you in check and give you a bit of sense of perspective about your achievements as a writer?
So important. Yeah, I can't emphasize enough how important it is for writers at all stages of the journey to be meeting, liaising, befriending other writers. I've got different groups of writer friends, but, you know, and we meet in different places, like you've described. We meet at book events or for coffees and things. And I think some people are published, some are not. Some are self-publishing, some are writing fast fiction. It's all and all genres. But I think these interactions are so precious, because, you know, you don't have that connection with your normal friends, your ordinary friends. And when you sit down with a bunch of writers, I often feel there's not much small talk. We get straight to the conversation. And what I like about it is people don't often ask you about your husband or your kids or your other work. We just talk about writing. There was one day we were there and there was a grand final on and no one knew who was playing, something like that. Like, how wonderful to be in Brisbane and no one knew who was in the grand final. And I thought, these are my people. But I also think if you suddenly became overnight massively famous and you were then touring the world, promoting your book or whatever, you would actually, we would all look back on these days of just meeting for coffees in West End in Brisbane with such fondness. And those would be, like, if you were a famous bands would always talk about jamming in their parents' garage when they were teenagers. This is our garage days. We're like hanging out. There's no pressure. There's no judgment. And it's, and we're all there for the pure fun of it. And I think that's something at the heart of being a writer, is the pure joy of writing and sharing that joy with other people. I think also, here's something critical I will say about the Australian writing industry. I think that our writer festivals in general, the big writing festivals, are not very inclusive. They're not very democratically organized. And I think that's really problematic. So I will go to the Brisbane Writers Festival year after year after year. And there's heaps of writers there and we all mingle and talk, but you don't get access to the famous authors who are on the panels. They are whisked off to a green room. There's no cocktail party where everyone, you could buy a ticket and go and try and meet the famous author. And the famous authors are chosen and invited. And I think, I would imagine there's a fair bit of lobbying from big publishing houses over who is included and who isn't. So, you know, there might be people sitting next to me in the audience who've published a book last week, but they weren't included. They weren't invited to the festival as a guest. So therefore they're there as a reader, but there's this real gap between the chosen writers and the unchosen writers. I don't think that is a healthy literary scene. And I was just at a writers' festival in Tasmania, which did the opposite of that. And it was brilliant. It's the Terra Australis Festival. It was in Port Huon in the Huon Valley. And there were amazing authors there, from Anne Cleves, who flew in from the UK, to Gary Disher, Karen Brook, Danuka McKenzie, so many big name authors. But I was fortunate to be invited as one of the writers, but we were all in the room with everyone. And at the dinner on the Saturday night, all the authors were scattered through every single table. So every table of reader had a couple of published authors on their table. And of course, many people that attend these kind of festivals are emerging authors or aspiring writers or published writers. So it was just really lovely that it was a celebration of literature, that we were all there together, breaking bread, having a glass of wine. It wasn't like the chosen and the unchosen.
The writing community has been for me absolutely one of the highlights of getting involved, because prior to getting published, I was just doing my own thing and flitting between projects and wasn't really connecting with anyone or reaching out and engaging. And once I got my contract, I then sort of found these kidlit groups and, you know, other writing groups for sort of writing across all genres. And it's definitely been just a phenomenal highlight. But sometimes you do feel that there's a sense of that, well, now you're an emerging author, so you're on this tier and now you can, you know, I don't know, buy courses or advice from writers who are on the next tier and, you know, and so on. But it can definitely feel a little bit segmented. So I think, as you mentioned, those opportunities to meet in a cafe or to have an actual chat where you are, you know, a real genuine community are incredibly valuable.
I think so too. And I also think that we should all, as authors, and I sort of believe this about life in general, don't wait for something to happen to give you that permission to be a certain way. And I look at writers that I admire and I think, what are you doing? How are you living your professional life? And then I try to do the same thing. So, you know, we've started organising these women who write crime lunches. And so that's a wonderful networking opportunity in Brisbane, and anyone is welcome who writes crime. And I've always said every novel is a crime novel, even a picture book, there's always a crime somewhere. You know, everyone is welcome. But that's us creating that networking opportunity that for people at every stage of the writing journey. So you don't actually have to wait till you get published to meet other authors, because what a shame to have to wait, you know, wait for a publishing house to give you permission to move in that writerly circle when everyone is welcome. It just seems a bit crazy. And there's no difference between, you know, there's no difference between a writer who's been published and a writer who hasn't been published. You know, we're all doing the same thing.
That idea of getting permission is just, I think, just applies to so many aspects of what we do or what we don't do. And I think we definitely wait on that to sort of hold us back. Like I was saying earlier about, you know, if you knew you could write four manuscripts and the fifth one would, then you would do it. And I guess you've I'm always really impressed with people who've got lots of published or finished manuscripts under their belt, because my big issue is with my grown-up writing is I just never get to the 50,000 words or the 60 or 70 or 80,000 words. I get maybe 15,000 words and then I flip and I pivot. And I'm definitely waiting for, I don't know what, some kind of universal validation that says, if you do this, it will be okay. Or yes, you can do this. It's okay for you to do this, which is like everything we've talked about here, just a ridiculous way to approach something.
Maybe you need to write the ending and then fill in the blanks in the middle.
I have just started just a little bit in line with your write like it's never going to be read, which I love and will definitely be, you know, trying to filter my thought process through. But I just do that. Just write anything. You can be proud of how rubbish this is. It doesn't matter. If this is the worst thing, just be proud of the words that you've got them down, because once you know, you can't, that old cliche, you can't edit a blank page.
Yes.
If it sits in your head as, you know, potential perfection, that's the failure, is the not getting it out on paper because you're too scared or you're too second guessing. And I do that thinking about, you know, well, what happens if my mum reads this scene and you know, this person from school that I haven't thought about for 20 years, if I write this, what will they think of me? And you go, who cares? Your practical brain doesn't care, but your internal sort of creative self is so hung up on these ridiculous blocks to just getting it done and getting your story out there.
We do worry a lot about how we are perceived as a writer. And I think that one of the important things of being a writer is blocking out your own voices, like blocking those voices out when you're writing. And like you said, once you've been published once, you've had a taste of criticism. And so you have a better ability to imagine their reaction to the next thing you're going to write. I think you just want to write from the heart and be honest, and that will make for good writing.
I think it's just that vulnerability as well of laying yourself out there that people that people go, oh, this is who you really are. I don't know. It's just, it's ridiculous. I just think your brain throws up whatever it can because it's vulnerable and scary and real. So your brain will throw whatever it wants in front of you to stop you doing it, even though it's that moving towards discomfort thing, I think, is where you find your good stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. Well said.
Well, I don't, poorly said, but a good message. What moments stand out to you in your writing journey as being particularly joyous, or what really brings you joy, big or little, when you're writing?
It's really simple. I feel it makes me feel good. When I sit down at the desk, I know I've got my writing time ahead of me, however long that is, an hour or a couple of hours. I sit down and I just feel good. I feel really good. And when I finish, I walk away feeling really good.
As you head into 2024, what's next for you with your writing journey?
I'm hoping, my dream for this year is to get one of my manuscripts under contract. And my agent, similarly to me, is tentatively optimistic that this is what will happen. And then I will start something new. And that, it for me, is the most exciting bit. I just love the blank page.
And where can people find you if they want to find out more about the Bay of Fires or Vanishing Falls or what's coming up for you?
They can find me on Instagram. Instagram is my favourite, and I share lots of book reviews there. They automatically share over to Facebook, and I am on Twitter occasionally.
All right, Poppy, well, thank you for your time, and thank you for talking me through some of your failures, some of your challenges, and some of your successes as a writer.
Thanks for having me. It was lovely to chat with you, Beck.
Thank you for listening to All the Ways I've Failed. You can find details about our guests and their work in the show notes, and you can find me on Instagram at All the Ways I've Failed or at Beck Marshall Say. Please rate and review wherever you listen to podcasts so that others can hear the beautiful and generous stories of our wonderful guests. Life to live.